Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. Our selection this month is by a longtime contributor to our pages. Frances M. Nevins is one of the foremost scholars of crime and mystery fiction, and also the author of two long-running mystery fiction series. He's had both fiction and nonfiction published in EQMM. For this podcast, we've chosen a story from his series featuring Lauren Mensing, a law professor turned sleuth. There are both novel and short story-length cases starring Lauren Mensing, and this tale, Night of Silk and Snow, was originally published in the November 1994 issue of our magazine. It is read here by the author and Christine Gilsonan.
He sat most of the night in the high-rise suite's bay window, watching soft, feathery snow slide down from the black sky and coat the sleeping city in white, trying to ease his anguish with the cool, detached thinking of a lawyer. From one perspective, he told himself, the person responsible for all but the first crime was the President of the United States, or at any rate, whichever political correctness guru had told the President he had to be perceived as reading more books by women. Whoever had dreamed up the notion that at the end of the President's evening jog, he should casually drop in at a Washington bookshop that just happened to be open late, and should purchase and then offhandedly recommend to the reporters surrounding him a novel, almost any novel, with a female byline. The presidential pick had been Slumber Party by an unsung author named Margaret Crane. Within a week, she was sung to the rafters. Within 2 weeks, her book was on every bestseller list. And by month's end, her agent had signed a $3 million movie deal with the hottest young director in Hollywood. 10 days after the deal was closed, her husband left her and filed for divorce, and for his equitable share of the windfall. That was the crucial link in the chain of events that hadn't yet ended, but had left Lauren Mensing sitting alone in a night of silk and snow, trying to ease his anguish. That fall semester, he was teaching an evening section twice a week. On those days, he would walk the 3 miles from his condo to school, and after class let out at 9:50 p.m., he would treat himself first to a few drinks at the Legal Eagle Tavern a block from the University Law Center, and then at closing time to a cab home. The bar was all but empty on that raw fall night, and he was nursing another bourbon and decaf at a corner table, with an enlarged still of Gregory Peck from To Kill a Mockingbird framed on the wall behind him, at right angles to a framed enlargement of John Barrymore from Counselor of Law. He didn't see her until she was standing over him, and then he didn't recognize her.
Was I that forgettable?
She asked the question in the cool, sophisticated tone of the female lead in a romantic comedy film from the 30s. Without waiting for an invitation, she dropped into the chair beside him. Lauren struggled to keep befuddlement out of his face as he studied her. Tall, late 30s, curly ash blonde hair, no makeup, wearing designer jeans under her main coat. She ordered a double maker's mark straight up from the exhausted barmaid hovering over her, and then Lauren remembered. 6 years ago, a bitter cold night in the first week of January. Airports all over the Northeast and Midwest shut down by snow and ice storms. Lauren's flight back from the annual meeting of the Association of American Law Schools, along with dozens of other flights from countless starting points and with countless destinations, had been diverted to Chicago. Hundreds of numbed and frustrated travelers were packed like freight in airport vans and hauled through snow-choked access roads to whatever hotels and motels the airlines had made arrangements with. He was standing straddle-legged in the rear of the van when a skid on an ice patch sent her sprawling into him, and they had helped each other up and begun talking. Later, they had shared a drink in the bar of their motel, Maker's Mark straight up, on her recommendation, and when they decided they were too wired for sleep, they went for a post-midnight swim in the heated basement pool. Thanks to the late hour and the fact that most of their fellow strandees either hadn't had swimwear in their luggage or had been traveling with just a carry-on bag, they had the pool to themselves. The motel was built on a hillside, and two of the basement walls were sheets of glass. They could float warm and relaxed in the pool and gaze out at huge soft snowflakes sifting down to the silenced earth. After a while, the woman had ducked under water, and the next thing Lauren saw was her teal-blue maillot flying in an arc to the lip of the pool. Then she streaked away to the deep end and began swimming laps past him, keeping her distance at first as if to test him, then stroking closer and closer until she slithered up into his arms and clung to him in a sort of erotic desperation. It was the first time he had made love in water. The rest of the night they had spent in his room.
Just first names. I want this to stay magical.
What name had she given him? He thought she could have called herself Peggy. When he woke at 7 in the morning, he was alone. She wasn't on the airport van that shuttled him back to O'Hare an hour later. He never saw her again. Sometimes he wondered if he dreamed her.
The security guard at the law school told me I might find you here after class.
She took a healthy sip of her bourbon, as if she needed for courage.
Lauren, Professor Mensing.
She tried to hold back a giggle, but it slipped out.
It's crazy. We've been lovers, but I don't know what to call you. I think I need your help.
I guess we're beyond just first names, then. She looked puzzled for a moment before her face cleared.
You mean, how did I find out who you were? Well, your picture does get in the papers now and then, even in Missouri. And when the media began focusing on me a few months ago, I thought of you. But you don't know anything about me except my first name, do you?
She took another sip of Maker's Mark, this time a dainty one.
I am Marnie Crane.
If Lauren had been drinking any of his own laced coffee, he would have spluttered it all over himself. The slumber party woman, propelled to celebrity status by presidential decree. Weren't Peggy and Marnie both diminutives for Margaret? You don't look much like your picture in Newsweek. In the flesh, you're much prettier. Then he caught the implication of his words and felt his ears burn.
It's lousy. I hate every photograph of myself I've ever seen, and I almost never let anyone shoot me. The professional job on the dust jacket of my book isn't too bad.
Haven't seen the book. Sorry. You live out on the edge of St. Louis County, right? I did read in Newsweek about your husband moving out and filing for divorce, and a half interest in your copyright. Is that litigation what brought you here?
Partly curiosity about you, but mostly that. I would like you to represent me.
I'm not licensed to practice in Missouri.
Along with my attorney there. From what I've read about you, I'm hoping you'll come up with a strategy my regular lawyer wouldn't have thought of in 1,000 years. I can pay you very well to try.
The law school pays me reasonably well to teach. Her soft brown eyes seemed to glow with shadowed light.
The fee needn't be just in cash.
At midnight, when the bar closed, they cabbed downtown to the high-rise hotel, where under an assumed name she had taken a suite on the executive floor. They sat in flanking tan leather armchairs in the empty lounge reserved for that floor's tenants, and looked out at the phantom glow from the nightlights of the city as he listened to the rest of her story. A woman in her early 30s, attractive, living for years in an emotional shell after a short, disastrous marriage to an abusive drunk when she was not yet 20, beneficiary of a share in a trust fund created under the will of a distant cousin's widow whose predeceased husband had been the founder of the Crane Chemical Empire. Blessed with a guarantee of $40,000 to $50,000 of unearned income for the rest of her life, Margaret Crane had lived quietly in a modest frame house on a hill overlooking one of the westernmost suburbs of St. Louis County, reading, gardening, keeping a diary, tinkering off and on with various drafts of the novels she had dreamed of writing since her days as a literature major under Stanley Elkin and Howard Nemiroff at Washington University. She had driven into St. Louis one Sunday afternoon for a jazz recital and happened to meet a man, tall, thin, prematurely gray, soft-spoken, gentle, and eaten alive by barely acknowledged loneliness as she herself was. His name was John Burke, and he was a graduate of the University of Missouri Law School, but had discovered he had minimal aptitude for the practice and was eking out a modest living as a municipal bond broker.
The first movie we saw together was a revival of Marnie, the Hitchcock picture. That's what he started calling me. He said I reminded him of Tippi Hedren.
After a few weeks, she had felt herself falling in love again. Terrified at the prospect of making another wrong choice, she ran. That was 6 winters ago, when the blizzard had grounded her plane at O'Hare, and chance had thrust her against Lauren in the van trundling stranded travelers to motels. Did you put me in your diary?
half a page, and I have tiny handwriting.
Sometime during her 3 months on the run from herself, she had found the answer. Margaret Crane and John Burke were married by a judge in the St. Louis County Courthouse one morning late in February.
It was a terribly windy day. The license blew out of Jack's hand as we were running across the plaza from the clerk's office to the courtrooms, and we had to chase after it.
There were no witnesses, no bridesmaid or best man, just the two of them. Jack had given up his apartment in Midtown St. Louis, moved into her house, and encouraged her to resume serious work on her novel.
He did the cooking several nights a week so I'd have more time to write.
Eventually, she was satisfied with Slumber Party, and the manuscript was submitted to one publisher after another. A year and a half later, a small house offered her a contract. When it was published, it attracted the same attention and readership as almost every other first novel, next to none. Until the evening of that carefully orchestrated visit to a Washington bookshop at the end of the presidential jog, followed within a few short weeks by heaps of fame and money.
That was when Jack changed. It was as if the man I knew and loved had crumbled to dust and a stranger had taken his place. He blew up at me, day after day, for no reason. Twice he slapped me. I swear I never asked for any of that money and attention, but Jack bitterly resented me for getting it out of the blue, while he had to keep slogging away as a bond salesman. And then I suppose he started thinking about the situation like a lawyer.
That's when he moved out and sued for a divorce?
We call it dissolution in Missouri. He filed for divorce and for a judgment that he owns half the copyright in Slumber Party and the other novel I wrote while the first one was making the rounds. It's called Woman Things. It won't be out for a few months yet, and already there are movie offers in the six figures.
Is his lawyer any good?
He's representing himself.
That's usually a bad mistake. You know the old saying, a lawyer who represents himself as a fool for a client?
Jack is no fool. I'm afraid this is a very simple case. He doesn't need to cut someone else in on what he can squeeze out of me.
What makes you so sure he's entitled to a half interest? I don't remember Missouri as being a community property state.
The courts in Missouri do what most states do nowadays in divorce cases. They practice what's called equitable distribution of marital assets. Practically speaking, it's almost the same as community property. Thank heaven he can't take any of the trust fund.
Okay, so how can I possibly help you? In the night glow, she pressed her lips together until they were a thin pencil line of flesh, slightly darker than her face.
I don't know. Moral support? Maybe investigating Jack's life before we met? Finding some dirt I could use to make him drop his financial claim?
That's a job for a private detective. I'm sure your lawyer's thought of that already. Wait a minute, here's a thought. Suppose you claim you'd written most of Slumber Party before you married him. Wouldn't that take the copyright out of the category of marital assets and make it like your trust fund, something he can't reach? She chewed on her lower lip in concentration.
I'm afraid it wouldn't help much. All but a few scenes of the final draft were written after our honeymoon. I discarded most of what I'd done when I was single.
Could he prove that?
I hate to admit it, but yes, he could, very easily, by subpoenaing my diary. I kept detailed notes on how the script was going.
Damn. Lauren stifled a yawn, realized that he was more than half asleep, and glanced at his wristwatch. Peggy? Marnie?
I guess I still think of myself as Marnie.
It's way past my bedtime. Why don't I grab a cab home, and we can talk more about your problem in a day or two, after I had time to give it some more thought. Are you staying in town that long?
Maybe a lot longer.
She hesitated, her eyes squinting in concentration.
I'm just a little afraid to go home.
For heaven's sake, why?
Suppose something should happen to me while I'm still legally married. The income from my trust fund would shift to the other Cranes I've never met, but Jack would wind up with half of everything else.
You mean your will leaves half your estate to him?
It used to leave him everything. After we were married, we made wills in each other's favor. When he walked out and started divorce proceedings, I hired my own lawyer, and he told me to tear up my will right away, and I did.
You made a new will?
I don't have any family to leave my property to. And I'm afraid I've never had a favorite charity. But my lawyer said if I died without a will, before the divorce became final, Jack would take everything by intestate succession. But if I died and had a will, he could claim against it and be entitled to half. I figured he'd be tempted less if I had a will, so I made a new one, leaving everything to whoever would get my estate under the laws of intestate succession. It was the only way I could think of to handle the situation.
She paused, just long enough so that Lauren stopped concentrating on the legal issue and focused on her.
I don't think it's worked. I believe someone's been following me the last few days.
Jack?
No. A man much younger than Jack, a stranger. Or maybe my overheated imagination.
Lauren stood up from the leather chair and strode to the glass-paneled lounge door as if he half expected to see an assassin with a gun on the other side. I'm taking you to your room now. You're going to put on the deadbolt before I go downstairs. I'll call you in the morning. He looked at his wristwatch. Late.
That would be nice.
He was grateful that nothing in her voice invited him to two more, because at that hour he was too exhausted either to love or protect her properly. With the barrier of her suite door between them, they softly wished each other good night a few minutes later. He called a cab from a payphone in the lobby and was waiting at the corner for a glowing roof light to appear on the night-cloaked street, when a man came out of the shadow of the bar diagonally across from the hotel and trotted in Lauren's direction. A young man of bantamweight build, dressed in contemporary grunge, reversed baseball cap, dark warm-up jacket, and sweatpants. Untrimmed mustache blending into half a week's whiskers. His face made him seem near 30, but probably he was closer to 20.
Yo! Four Eyes! Clark Kent! You with the glasses!
His voice was weak and hoarse, and he kept clearing his throat, as if something were wrong with his larynx. Lauren felt knots form in his stomach, but made himself face the youth.
Next time I even think you and her are together, you both get a slice cut out of each eyeball. Clear?
Grunge kept his hands buried in his sweatpants pockets. Lauren prayed he wasn't carrying a knife there. Hoped against hope for a patrol car to glide along one of the cross streets. Nothing moved in any direction. It was as if they were the last creatures alive in the city. Lauren swallowed fear.
You wondering why I care, stud?
Lauren was silent, fighting the urge to vomit in the gutter.
It's 'cause that slut's my mother!
He made a gesture of obscene contempt and turned his back so that Lauren could see the St. Louis Cardinals logo on his cap and jogged away into the shadows. When the cab drew up a minute later, Lauren asked the driver to circle the block, but by then the youth had melted back into the empty night. The first thing he did, after deadbolting himself into his own condo, was to reach for the phone and wake up an old friend, a retired detective captain who now headed a private security agency. 10 minutes of conversation, and it was agreed. The agency's best available operative would be in the hotel lobby first thing in the morning, with instructions to call Marnie Crane's suite, explain Lauren's arrangement, and offer protection. The next thing Lauren did was try to get some sleep. He failed. Too many turbulent memories whirled through him. When he reached his office a little before noon the next day, he found 3 pink message slips thrust under his door, all from her number at the hotel. She picked up on the first ring, and he told of his encounter with Grunge in the deserted street. Now we know who's been following you. Now you see why I arranged for a bodyguard.
Lauren,
She seemed unable to speak for several seconds.
I appreciate your concern, but whoever that young man is, he can't be my son.
She heard the question in Lauren's puzzled silence and answered it without being asked.
I have never had a child or been pregnant. I've been sterile all my life.
Lauren had never studied or offered a course in copyright law, but 5 years earlier, a faculty colleague who, among other subjects, taught intellectual property had had to undergo bypass surgery in mid-semester, and Lauren had wound up taking over that class for a month. After Marnie had flown home without incident and an agency in St. Louis County had taken over the security function, he remembered his old lecture notes and spent 2 days poring through them for a legal point he had scrawled down at the time but never pursued. When he found it again, he put in a week's worth of evenings on research. Then he made 2 long-distance calls, first to Marnie and later to her divorce lawyer,
a superannuated solo practitioner named Kurzweil, whose phone voice was a senile cackle. That evening, but this time at a decent hour, he again called his friend the retired captain and hired the agency for a research job beyond his own capacity. His free time during the rest of the semester he devoted to writing a brief for the St. Louis County Circuit Court. An hour after his final class of the term, he caught a flight to Lambert International Airport, where Marnie and Kurzweil were waiting near the luggage carousels. The lawyer's hair was the color of dirty snow, and his face was wrinkled like a crumpled map. Lauren rented a Camry and followed them to the Ritz-Carlton, a luxury hotel in the county seat of Clayton. They sat over an elegant high tea and conferred, with Lauren lecturing more than he would have in class. Halfway across the room, a short, balding, triple-chinned man of perhaps 40 was loudly sipping tea, wolfing pettifor, and carefully not looking at the Crane party's table. Lauren remembered seeing the man in the tea room when he himself and Marnie and Kurzweil had entered. Her local bodyguard, he had thought, out of his element here like a fat carp in champagne. When the conference broke up and he was alone in his suite on the top floor, he phoned the manager of the St. Louis agency, who laughed at Lauren's question uproariously. "Wrong church, wrong pew. You didn't come close to spotting our security professor. Remember seeing a bland middle-aged couple, quiet as mice, sitting in the lobby as you went into the tea room?" "Didn't think you would. Those were our guys. Married couple, 20 years apiece in the Secret Service before they went private. They followed you in from the airport and beat you into the hotel while you were parking. I just got off the phone with them before you called."
"They never came into the tea room, just hung out in the lobby?"
"They came in 10 minutes behind you, had their eyes on you every second. You just never made them. That's why they're detectives and you're not."
"Did they notice the fat guy?"
"Not only notice him, they think they can ID him. Woman sneaked a snap of him with a midget camera in her compact. We'll check around and let you know in a day or so."
Another stalker in Marnie's life, Lauren thought, and remembered that he'd better ask about the first one, the bandit-mustached youth who had claimed to be her son.
"Missed him too, huh?"
The agency manager knew Lauren was paying his bill, but couldn't seem to keep his contempt for an amateur out of his voice.
"Kid was out of the airport when you flew in. He stayed 50-60 yards away from you and the woman and the lawyer, but he was there. Followed you into Clayton in a dark gray 92 Nissan Sentra, but didn't go into the hotel. Our couple spotted him, but stuck to the script and stayed with your party. We have no idea where he went, but we got his license number. Give us a day. Any other way we can serve you, Professor?"
Lauren said nothing for more than a minute, the phone handset pressed to his ear, eyes squeezed shut as he thought furiously. "Just one more thing. How are your contacts with the police out here?"
"Hell of a lot better than PIs in storybooks, or else we wouldn't be in business. Why do you care?"
"Because I want you to get hold of whatever doctor they use when they need to get more details from a witness and arrange for the person to hypnotize me." On a chilly Thursday morning, he stood at a lectern in the Kniep courtroom of St. Louis University School of Law, with a clamorous potpourri of students and media people at his back, a handful of curious professors in the jury box off to one side, and a copy of his brief before him. The judge, hearing his motion, had seen the potential importance of the issue Lauren had raised, and, being both an alumnus of the law school and a member of its adjunct faculty, had arranged for the oral argument to be held in its moot court facility, where interested students and professors as well as the press could attend. Marnie Crane, in a long-skirted midnight blue ensemble and her hair pinned back in a businesslike French twist, sat at the polished counsel table to Lauren's left, with little Kurzweil nervously twisting his ancient fingers beside her. At an identical table to Lauren's right sat gray-thatched Jack Burke, alone and frowning. The judge rapped his gavel 3 times, and the courtroom buzzing died.
"Your Honor, as you know, I have been admitted to the Missouri Bar pro hac vice for purposes of arguing this motion. It's unusual for a state court to have to decide an issue of federal copyright law, and especially one that so few lawyers are aware of, but this is the court's duty today. Section 201E of the Copyright Act of 1976 is as clear as the legislative drafting can ever be."
Judge Dumbleton peered over a bench at Lauren through huge-lensed trifocals and spoke into the portable microphone set up for him.
Perhaps for the benefit of those in the audience who have not read your brief, Professor, you should recite the section.
Even with the mic, his voice was close to inaudible. Kurzweil had told Lauren over high tea that behind the judge's back, the courtroom crowd called him Mumbleton.
With pleasure, sir.
Lauren turned to page of his brief. Quote, when an individual author's ownership of a copyright, or of any of the exclusive rights under a copyright, has not previously been transferred voluntarily by that individual author, no action by any governmental body or other official organization purporting to seize, expropriate, transfer, or exercise rights of ownership with respect to the copyright or any of the exclusive rights under a copyright shall be given effect under this title. Unquote. The only exception to this rule is in bankruptcy cases. We contend that the plain meaning of 201E is to preclude state courts from dividing up an author's copyright interests as matrimonial property in a divorce action.
Why would Congress have wanted to deprive state courts of this power?
Lauren had strained to make out the question.
I'm not sure the result was consciously intended. As my brief indicates, Section 201E was first proposed in 1973 when the Soviet Union joined the Universal Copyright Convention. There was fear in certain quarters that the Soviet government would pass internal legislation nationalizing the copyrights of dissidents like Solzhenitsyn, and then be able to sue in the courts of other countries, including the United States, and have the publication of dissidents' works enjoined. Section 201E was designed to thwart any such ploy.
Professor, your brief states that originally the section denied legal effect only to foreign governmental expropriations of copyright, but does not explain why it was broadened to cover expropriations by our own federal or state governments.
The legislative history makes it clear that it wasn't broadened by inadvertence. But no one involved in the process seems to have realized that they were creating an interface between copyright and divorce law that hadn't existed before. Nevertheless, the language of the provision is clear, and the principle is squarely in line with several other changes in the 1976 Copyright Act that expand authors' rights.
The court is bothered by the way 201E discriminates against women.
The judge's glance flitted about the courtroom as if in search of approving nods from media feminists.
Does it not deny married women their equitable share of the copyrightable works created during their marriage?
It discriminates against women only if you assume that all or most authors are men. A glance at the counsel table to my left will show the court that the author in this case is not. A few minutes with the card catalog of this university's library, or any library in America, will show the court that vast numbers of authors are women. Section 201E treats men and women exactly alike. It protects the author's spouse from involuntary transfer of copyrights, regardless of which sex the author happens to be.
Thank you, Professor Mensing. The court will now hear opposing counsel.
Lauren took the empty chair beside Marnie at the counsel table as Jack Burke, in his pinstriped lawyer suit, rose with brief in hand and replaced Lauren at the lectern.
May it please the court. As the court knows, I am a member of the Missouri Bar, representing myself in this matter. I am by no means an expert on copyright law.
Nor is anyone in this room, Dumbleton said. Unless, of course, the fellow who teaches at the school is present.
The audience tittered and giggled as courtroom spectators will when a feeble joke is cracked by a judge on the bench.
Proceed, counsel.
Your Honor, the only reported decision raising the 201E issue is In Re Marriage of Worth, decided by the California Court of Appeals in 1987. The court in that case flatly rejected Professor Mensing's thesis and ruled, first, that copyrights were community property under California law, and second, that that law was not preempted by Section 201E of the Copyright Act.
Missouri, of course, is not a community property state.
For purposes of this issue, there is simply no significant distinction between community property states and those that practice equitable division of matrimonial assets upon divorce. Furthermore, at least one of the two leading law review articles on the subject contends that the very act of an author's getting married should be treated as implied consent to judicial division of copyright interests if the marriage dissolved. If there's implied consent, there's no involuntary transfer, and therefore no 201 issue.
The other leading article, the one cited in Professor Mensing's brief, I believe contains just the opposite.
Indeed, Your Honor. But Lauren had prepared thoroughly, and none of Burke's arguments surprised him. The active part of his mind began to wander. After a while, he realized that both what Burke said and how he said it were disturbing him profoundly.
Marnie slipped her hand into Lauren's beneath the counsel table, and he could feel her tremble as if something in that packed courtroom beneath its oval of harsh light was terrifying her.
"Thank you for an excellent presentation,"
Judge Dumbleton cut Burke off after what seemed to Lauren like hours.
"The court could take the matter under advisement. And thank you all for coming. I look forward, you students, to your practicing before me in a few years, if I'm still alive then."
The room exploded in another round of titters as Dumbleton pounded his gavel, rose, and meandered off stage to a private exit. Three university security guards moved along the center aisle, gently herding students and reporters out of the chamber.
"We're going to lose."
Marnie whispered the words to her lawyers as the courtroom emptied. Lauren felt an uneasy pang. Where was the agency bodyguard who was supposed to be watching her? The three of them and Burke were alone in the room now.
"That judge has decided against us already. I can feel it."
"I think our argument went very well indeed."
Kurzweil croaked the words as if half the credit for it were his.
"No."
She twisted in her chair to face Lauren.
"We have to settle now. Maybe he'll take a quarter or a third of the copyright if we..."
Burke nodded curtly to his estranged wife and her legal team and strode past his adversary's table and up the carpeted aisle.
"Jack, wait."
She snatched her purse from the floor and trotted in his wake with Lauren and Kurzweil half a dozen steps behind her.
"She's gone crazy,"
the older attorney panted as they passed through the narrow vestibule to the main corridor of the law school.
"This is no time to..."
Lauren didn't wait for him to finish, but crossed the reception room to where several women students were congregated with disappointment on their faces and copies of Slumber Party clutched in their hands.
"She went in there, Professor."
One of the women pointed to the entrance door of the law library across the corridor.
"She was a few feet behind her husband, and then another man went in a few seconds after her."
The bodyguard, Lauren thought. Good.
"Wiry little guy with a thick mustache," another student chimed in. "Needs a shave."
Lauren's heart dropped. He whirled and raced into the library and through the turnstile with his eyes darting everywhere for Marnie and Burke, and then he saw them huddled together halfway down a narrow aisle flanked by high, orange-painted steel shelves, and he ran toward them frantically, waving his arms.
"Get out! He's in here somewhere! Both of you, out now!"
Marnie's mouth opened in the birth of a gasp of fright. He seized her arm and hustled her along the aisle with a fuddled Burke in their rear, and the three of them stormed out of the library into the main corridor, where Lauren hunted wildly for some sign of the bodyguard, but saw only a few knots of students and Kurzweil.
"Will you kindly tell me what..."
Burke began. That was the moment when hell came loose. The whiskered youth stepped out of the library behind them and drew a semi-automatic pistol from his jacket and dropped to a combat crouch, screaming,
"Slut! You damned whore!"
as he aimed at Marnie and Burke, who stood paralyzed 6 inches apart, and the pistol made a coughing sound and there was a stereophonic screaming from the panicked students in the reception area. Lauren dived for Marnie and knocked her to the floor and heard the coughing of the pistol and felt Burke tumbling on top of him and felt blood on his back and thought for an endless moment that he'd taken the bullet himself, and then he knew it was Burke's blood oozing down him.
"You okay?"
he panted. Marnie was ghost-faced and silent but didn't seem to be bleeding. Lauren crawled erect as university security guards surrounded him.
"George is chasing him down Lindell Boulevard. He's a Marine reservist and a Gulf War vet. He'll catch the bastard. Cops are on the way."
A tall, young black guard looked up from where he knelt with a hand on Burke's carotid artery.
"This one's gone," he said. "Lady seems okay."
"Oh, Jack. Oh, God."
Lauren struggled to her and held her close as the wailing of sirens came nearer.
"Two of them."
The axe-faced detective lieutenant pulled his earlobe and frowned at Lauren across the desktop, littered with food wrappings, styrofoam cups, and official paper.
"A tag team."
It was mid-afternoon. The temperature had dropped 20 degrees, and forecasters were predicting snow. Kurzweil had vanished long ago. Marnie was in her own suite at the Ritz-Carlton under police guard and sedation, and Lauren still sat on the edge of the splintery chair in the lieutenant's cubicle, trying to absorb and align what they now knew. The first thing they learned was why the agency bodyguard had vanished. Sitting in the courtroom audience, he'd spotted the other hitman, the balding fat one, who in turn had sensed he'd been recognized and made a hasty exit. The bodyguard had taken a fool's chance, leaving Lauren and Marnie unprotected while he tried, without success, to catch the fat man.
Which gave Tubby's sidekick the opening to take the lady out. Only his aim was off.
By then, they had recovered the semi-automatic which the young gunman had tossed down a Lindell Boulevard sewer in his flight from Fearless George, and a usable print had told the police who he was. As luck would have it, the shooter might easily have served with George in the desert.
7 years in the infantry. Won all sorts of marksmanship medals, got terminated in the defense cutbacks, chose killing civilians for his new career. He's been a suspect in a few hits for hire around St. Louis, but this is the first time he's left righteous evidence behind.
And he thought Marnie Crane was his mother?
Ah, that was a load of bull. His mother lives here in town, and he visits her every week. We have her placed under surveillance now in case he tries to hide with her.
Thanks to the surreptitious photo Lauren's private agency pair had snapped in the Ritz Tea Room, the fat one's identity was known too. He was a professional, with murder warrants out for him in 3 states. Lauren could hardly believe he hadn't noticed either hitman in the courtroom, but the place had been packed, his back had been to the audience, and his mind on the oral argument. He sat beside the chaotic desk and dredged deep into himself, trying to sort it all out while the lieutenant chewed dry bagels, slurped rancid coffee, fielded phone calls, shuffled papers, and behaved in general as if he were alone in the cubicle. When Lauren raised his head and cleared his throat, the lieutenant looked at him without interest. Then he went back to his paperwork, while Lauren wrestled the temptation to open the floodgates and tell the whole story. He sat in the dark bay window of his hotel suite and watched the silken snow sift down through the deep night and coat the city, and thought back to another snow-cloaked night almost 6 years ago. That was a beautiful night. The woman in the matching club chair at an angle to his seemed herself again, the shock and sedation worn away, but the carafe of wine they'd ordered with their late supper had not eased the tautness at the corners of her eyes and mouth. I remember that night as if it were yesterday.
I'll never forget it.
Tell me what you remember. He reached for her hand and took it between his own.
Well, I fell against you in that airport bus, and we had a few drinks in the motel lounge. Maker's Mark, straight up. Later we went down to the pool for a swim, and we could see the snow falling all around us through the glass walls.
Tell me something you didn't put in your diary later. The request shook her for a moment, then her teeth began to play with her lower lip.
Darling, how could you possibly know what I did or didn't put in my diary?
Behind the note of forced gaiety, Lauren heard fear. Because I drove to your house late this afternoon while you were sedated and broke in and searched till I found it. I don't have it with me now, but I made a photocopy of the half page about us. Tell me something that's not on it. The fear was crawling into her eyes now, and she took short breaths through her mouth as if there weren't enough air in the room.
My God, Lauren, I know you saved my life this morning, but breaking into my house.
So you owe me. I saved your life and your copyrights, too. Come on, just one detail.
She swallowed, licked dry lips, tried to concentrate.
You told me you were a law professor.
No, I didn't. All we exchanged were first names. You said you wanted the night to be magical, remember? You knew nothing about me till you read a write-up in the paper a few years later.
Oh, of course.
She tried to smile at him, but the acid of fear made it ghastly.
I'm sorry. Shock of seeing Jack murdered right in front of me has messed up my memory.
Let's try again. What color was your bikini, the one you wore on the pool that night?
Why, it was blue, Lauren. Why in the name of...
It wasn't a bikini. It was a mayo. Whose room did we make love in, yours or mine? What did the note say that you left on the pillow?
She sat in shrunken silence as Lauren stood and loomed over her. Come on, come on. One little detail.
I had myself hypnotized the other day, so hundreds of details came back, but I could remember so much of it before. Such a magical night, and it's a blank.
There was an ice storm. Both our planes were grounded in Chicago.
She began in a dull, trance-like, hopeless voice, and stopped.
You're not Margaret Crane. You look something like her, probably related, but you're not Marnie. She went back to St. Louis County and married Burke, and he brought you into the picture.
You got good at forging her signature, and you learned to look as much like her as possible. She was a loner. There weren't many people you had to fool. The two of you killed her and disposed of the body and settled back to enjoy $50,000 a year in trust income. Everything went fine until Clinton made a bestseller out of that novel she sold before she was murdered. Suddenly, money was pouring out on the two of you like that snow. Burke got greedy, dumped you, and sued for a half interest in the copyright. You couldn't blow the whistle on him without convicting yourself. Then you remembered that half page in the real Marnie's diary. You knew who I was and what I did from that news article, and you came to me for legal advice, but mainly to involve me in your next murder plan. That kid who stopped me on the street, threatened to kill us both, claimed to be your son. He was your hitman. You were setting the stage so when the right moment came, you'd go over next to Burke in some public place, and the gunman would pop out of nowhere and scream names at you, and seem to fire at you but hit Burke, leaving his lawsuit moot and the copyrights all yours. The shooter was a top marksman in the military, but you were still taking a big risk. I'm not surprised you needed sedation. She sat stunned and spent in the club chair, her eyes focused on the sifting snow and seeing nothing. You made some mistakes. Your biggest was telling me Burke was a failure as a lawyer. I heard him in court today, and it was perfectly plain to me and Judge Dumbleton that he was an excellent lawyer. But I sensed something wrong from the first time you approached me. I'm a middle-aged academic. There aren't many magical nights in my life. I remembered Marnie vividly. I always will. Something about you was subtly different. I didn't understand how you were using me until the shooter came out of the library screaming at you. I tried to knock both you and Burke to the floor, but not that either of you were worth saving. She shuddered uncontrollably like someone in an epileptic fit. Then she relaxed as if a crisis had passed, stood with her arm on the back of the club chair, and smiled at him almost fondly.
You win. I confess, it all happened just the way you figured it out.
For a moment, Lauren almost believed she looked stronger because she was sharing the bloody truth.
Now just what do you think you can do about it? I didn't live with Burke for 3 years without learning some law. You are my attorney. Whatever I tell you is a confidential communication. You have an ethical obligation never to repeat it to a soul.
He'd expected that, and had spent most of the long drive back from his break-in rehearsing his answer. The hell I do! As far as I'm concerned, my only obligation is to Marnie Crane, the real one. I don't owe you a damn thing. But let's just suppose you're right. Let's suppose it's unethical for me to go to the police. What's my punishment? Will I lose my license to practice law in Missouri? I don't have one, remember? I was admitted temporarily just to argue your motion. She tore at him with her eyes, but stayed silent and unmoving. But if it meant I could never appear in court anywhere again, it would be worth it to put you away. Do you think I'd let you get away with murdering? He stopped. He'd exposed too much of himself already. Get out! She stayed where she was like the stone image of a woman. A lamp across the room etched her reflection into the dark glass of the bay window.
You're going to tell the police?
Maybe I have already, and they're waiting for you in the corridor. Maybe I'll wait a while, see if the second hitman gets lucky. Her eyes widened with uncertainty, and he wanted to sing. You never saw him, but there was a fat, bald fellow in the tea room downstairs when we went in the other day. He was also in court with us this morning and would have killed you if the bodyguard hadn't spotted him and scared him off. He's still out there waiting for another crack at you. If he was in the tea room ahead of us, he must have known exactly where we were going. Only three people knew that, you, me, and Kurzweil. Remember how you told me Kurzweil had you make a will, leaving all your estate to whoever the real Marnie's intestate successors might be? Well, either he knew who they are or found out and made a deal with one or more of them for a piece of all your property, the house, the copyrights, everything, and then he hired the fat man, a professional killer. He waited and let the terror eat into her before he went on. I phoned Judge Dumbleton's chambers late this afternoon and learned something that confirmed my hunch. It wasn't the judge's own idea to hold the oral argument at the law school. It was Kurzweil's suggestion. The fat man couldn't have shot you in the county courthouse because everyone has to pass through a metal detector at the entrance doors. Law schools don't use them. That made you a sitting duck.
Oh, my God. My God, what can I do?
That is your problem. Maybe you'll be safe from him in a cell if you confess. Now get out. When she was gone, he deadbolted himself into the suite and went to the bay window and sat looking out at the night city in its blanket of softly falling snow, and wondered whether turning her in would mean the end of his professional life, and relive that other night of silk and snow, when the chain of events began.
I wish I could have known you better. I wish I could have saved you.
Night of Silk and Snow is copyrighted by Francis M. Nevins. Music for this podcast, entitled Premonition, was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Recording for the podcast was done by Gene Carroll and Jonathan Grimm, and mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.elleryqueenmysterymagazine.com.